You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 17th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Corey Robin, political science teacher at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. Also on the program, Jeff Smith from the Occupy Wall Street media team in Washington, D.C. for the J-17 Occupy Congress actions. All on this program. And for many of you, completely and totally free. Doesn't have to be that way. I guess this is not the greatest pitch. But if you become a member of the Majority Report, you guarantee this program continues. In addition, of course, to getting the better half of the program, which involves your phone calls, your IMs, sundry interviews. I think tomorrow we will do the seasteading ambassador. We'll bring him on. And folks, understand that your membership is the only thing. 98% of our operating budget comes from your memberships. We have no institutional grants, no foundations that support us, and frankly, I don't want them to. It's not like they're pounding on the door, let's be honest. But I would rather just your support. If you listen to the show on a regular basis, if you listen to it three or four times a week, we really seriously need your members. You can tell that we seriously need them because it's the first thing I'm talking about today. Last night was debate number 5,733 of the Republican primary. It's down to the most comfortable number of Republican primary, presidential primary hopefuls. By that, I mean all white guys. But sadly, I must report that a white guy has dropped out of the race, leaving only all white guys. And to be honest, they range in age from old to very old. So John Huntsman, it was weird. I think it was Sunday night or Saturday. I can't remember. I don't even know what day it is today. And I was watching the Mike Huckabee Fox News, who's the biggest right-wing nut job sweepstakes, where they each come out and it's like it was like an old Merv Griffin show for reactionaries. And literally, Huntsman was making his pitch to the people of South Carolina, and there was a massive news flash underneath him that said Huntsman's dropped out of the race. And so I kept expecting that he would say, I'm not in the race anymore. Why I'm here, which is really what he should have been saying from the first place. But Huntsman's gone. His father obviously said, I'm not going to fund your super PAC. I want to take this moment to express a certain amount of sympathy. I also have had some father issues in the past. I think I've mentioned on the show previously that when I was eligible for my driver's license, after I had spent 6 months with my learner's permit, my father wouldn't sign the document for like 2 or 3 months because I had an attitude problem. And so for John Huntsman, I just want to say, you and I, we're right here, buddy. It's a drag that your dad wouldn't give you $5, $10, $20 million so that you could continue to run for president. And, you know, so hang in there, dude. It gets better. It gets better. Let's play. If you missed the debate last night, our old friend Tim from back in the day at Air America sent over this audio compilation. I think it gets it more or less just right. I don't know if it includes Rick Perry saying that leaders of Turkey are now Islamic terrorists, but what's a world, you know, a NATO member's really Islamic terrorists or not between friends? So let's play this audio.
Andrew Jackson had a pretty clear-cut idea about America's enemies. Killed them.
Governor Romney, your father was born in Mexico.
Killed them.
I'm saying that the state of Texas is under assault by federal government.
Killed them.
This was a provision that said particularly targeted African Americans.
Killed them.
I went moose hunting, actually. Not moose hunting, I'm sorry. Elk hunting.
Killed them.
We endlessly bomb these countries, and then we wonder why they get upset with us.
Killed them.
I think that sums it up fairly well. We've got to take a break. And later in the after show today, I'm going to talk about my trip that I took to kill some milk. It's like a moose-elk hybrid. There's certain parts of the country, apparently, where they mate. And they spontaneously generate into a third species, and I killed it. With a crossbow. A gold crossbow. We got to take a break when we come back. Corey Robin.
You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't polite. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Brooklyn College CUNY Graduate Center teacher and the author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. You can also check out his blog. It's CoreyRobin.com.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And welcome to the show. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm really enjoying your book. I've been dancing around in it because that's the way I read now because my six-year-old daughter doesn't allow me to maintain a single thought for any period of time. But it's a fascinating book. And I want to start, with the notion that, in the book you break down some of the sort of the popular misconceptions about conservatism. One specifically that conservatism is sentimental and wants to return to an older time and is about tradition. But in fact, you point out that it really is only sentimental for a certain dynamic, and that in fact it's fairly radical in attempting to recreate this dynamic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, conservatism always begins in reaction to a movement, a democratic movement from the left that is trying to basically break hierarchical bonds between subordinates and superiors. Abolition, the French Revolution, the labor movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, all the great social movements of the left provoke a reaction on the right. And what's interesting about that reaction from the right is that rather than just defend the established order, what conservatives oftentimes do is they become very scorching critics of the established order. They say that the old elites have kind of gotten us into this situation because they were lazy, they were decadent, they were too materialistic. And so what they insist on is that those elites need to be kind of, you need to clean house, and you need to recreate the old regime. And so they're not defending what was. What they really are doing is recreating or creating something that never was in the first place, and oftentimes with the most sort of radical rhetoric and radical instruments.
And that that thing that they're recreating ultimately is sort of this is a hierarchical, I guess, a hierarchical dynamic where it is where the subject of that dynamic is always people who are looking to be emancipated, either sort of socially or economically.
That's correct. Women, slaves, African Americans, post-slavery workers. And the second part of what's interesting is that in trying to beat back these movements, not only do they recreate the old order and the old regime, but they also are smart enough and far-seeing enough to understand that you have to find a way of recreating the old order in such a way that the lower orders, women, blacks, can find a place for themselves, a new place for themselves. So it's not just simply recreating the old hierarchies. It's trying to find a way, that poorer people can imagine themselves to be part of the ruling class. So in the defense of slavery, you see the slaveholders being very cognizant that they can't just defend plantations. They have to find a way to make sure that all white men understand themselves to be either slaveholders or slaveholders in the making. So they broaden the definition of the ruling class, and you see this over and over and over again up until, you know, the Nixon silent majority, you know, trying to include white ethnics to be part of a kind of new ruling class that would exclude African Americans and so forth.
You know, when I was reading that part of your book, there were two things that came to mind. One was Welcome to the Dollhouse, this Todd Solondz movie where and I don't know if you saw it, but the lead is a 12-year-old girl. Maybe she's a little bit older. I'm not sure. And she would get picked on at school, but she would come home and then kick her daughter, essentially. And that's
right.
The dynamic, right? I mean, they're saying to that character, if you will, that, okay, you're not necessarily the leader or the boss, but you can be a boss.
You know, it's funny that you bring up that analogy. John Adams wrote a very important book called The Discourses on Davila. And in there, he talks about this exactly this dynamic. And he says, you know, the beggar on the street will never get rid of his dog, even if it would save his life, you know, because he could buy food or whatever. And when asked why, he'll say, well, who else would I have around that I basically can kick? Me feel like I'm the top dog around here. So that's exactly right. That's a very important part of the dynamic, is you don't level the playing field. You don't elevate people on the bottom. But what you do is you give those people who are near the bottom some power over people who are even closer to the bottom. You create these ever finer gradations on the bottom so that even if you're, you know, not a wealthy elite, you still can play the part of a little lord. And it's real. It's not just symbolic power. It's actual real power.
You know, there was I imagine you saw this as well, but recently there was a study that showed that the issue, when it comes to taxes, the issue is not that the reason why, we can talk more. I want to talk about this notion, because your notion sort of refutes the what's the matter with Kansas notion. But the idea that people don't want to pay taxes because they presume someday they will also be millionaires, but it's that they are concerned that their tax money is going to people who are poorer than them, and it may change the dynamic between those poor people and themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I think economists call this the last place aversion, that basically people are willing to put up with a tremendous amount of inequality, tremendous amount of superiority domination over them, so long as they can be assured that they're not the last person on the bottom, that that's the real thing that drives everything. Now, mine is, I want to be careful because I'm not trying to make a psychological argument about what lies at conservatism. It's much more about the intellectual and ideological arguments, the philosophical arguments. But it does dovetail with some of the sort of data that more empirically oriented social scientists have found.
And so this notion that that conservatives are tricking their followers into buying into an ideology that sort of subjugates them is, in fact, almost got it backwards.
Right. I think that conservatives are extraordinarily clear with their base about what they're all about, and I think their base, for the most part, understands what they are all about. Just look at something like the backlash against the civil rights movement. That was one of, most historians believe, you know, conservatism as a modern movement begins in the 30s in reaction to the New Deal, but it's not until the 60s and the 70s that it really becomes a kind of mass majority movement, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is the civil rights movement. And when conservatives start sort of recasting white supremacy as one of the kind of linchpins of what they're all about, that's not tricking anybody. They're saying that there is a population beneath you, African Americans, and that you stand above them. And people don't want to lose that kind of status and privilege and power. And so, again, I just don't see the subterfuge that's going on there. I mean, sometimes the language will try to massage what that, you know, that vision and sort of soften it slightly. But, you know, read Lee Atwater, read all these guys who designed this strategy. It's all very out there and, you know, and in the open.
And it also explains why you can have sort of the dovetail of sort of the, there's a dovetailing of the sort of the fundamentalist strain of republicanism, fundamentalist religious strain, because it also says that, you know, at the very least, we're going to make sure that you, and by you I mean a white male, you'll still be the head of the household.
Exactly. And it's not just the head of the household. I mean, that's a critical part. Again, the backlash against the women's movement was a huge boon for the Christian right, and ultimately the victory of Ronald Reagan. But remember, there's another component to this which relates to race, which I talk about in my book. Richard Viguerie, who was really one of the kind of leading architects of the Christian right and the new right, he said the single biggest thing that brought us recruits to the Christian right was the defense of what were called segregation academies in the New South. In other words, after the segregation orders came in, lots of white people pulled their children out of public schools and put them in, you know, were kind of religious schools, but the real purpose of them was that they were segregated, and they got a tax break for doing it because it was a religious school. The Nixon administration, of all people, of all places, tried to end the tax break, and that just sent, you know, just droves of Christian activists into the hands of the Christian right. And so it's the defense of the household, as you say, but it's also a defense of white supremacy, historically at least. It's obviously changed quite a bit since then, but that was one of the key factors.
And so ultimately, when we look at to understand at least the intellectual underpinnings of conservatism, and this gets sort of filtered out and plays on sort of some emotional tendencies, and I appreciate that you're not as interested, at least in the context of this book, in the sort of the psychological and the emotional responses. But it ultimately is just fundamentally anti-egalitarian, and not just in an economic sense, but in any sense of the word.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. It's what I say, it's against the sort of the quality of power, really, because I think power is a much more encompassing term than just economic resources. You know, for instance, during the New Deal, you know, the real thing that the business class fought more than anything else was not Social Security and unemployment compensation and things like that, although they did fight that. But the real thing was the unionization of the workforce, because that was about real personal control over the workplace. And that's really the key of my argument, is that these personal relationships of power that conservatives try to seek to defend, and on exactly the grounds that you're saying, that it's that they essentially believe that equality means the end of greatness and excellence and everything that's good in this world, and that inequality is key to making the world a better place, basically.
And I mean, how does that get translated down to the average Joe? I mean, in terms of like that concept of greatness, does it basically just say, well, you can still be great, we're just gonna make sure, you know, you just got to look at it within the context of your limited playing field?
I think it's a couple of ways. One is just that, what you just said, you know, that you are you partake of a version of greatness if you are, you know, a kind of low-level frontline supervisor in a factory, or if you're a father in your household, that you are in some way, shape, or form, you know, just a smaller version of an aristocrat or a king. So that's one very important stream. I think there's another, though, which is a little bit harder to get your hands on, but I think you see it in someone like Sarah Palin, who's no longer in the news, which is that the conservative has this idea that there's a kind of an extraordinary capacity for greatness out there in the population somewhere, and that when it emerges, it's kind of a miracle. And the historical analogy, I would say, is that there's long been an obsession on the French conservative right, going back to the 19th century, with Joan of Arc, this peasant girl who appears out of nowhere to save France, has, you know, no leadership skills as far as we can see before she comes on the scene. She has no experience. She has no education. She's just, you know, a kind of nothing who becomes a something, and it's almost like a miracle of God. And I think that's the other thing that conservatism, there's a real romanticism or romance of the extraordinary, which say someone like Sarah Palin, who kind of barely made it through college, who was a kind of completely lackluster, desultory governor, who showed very little awareness about international affairs, that somehow or another she was just going to kind of emerge on the scene, selected by, you know, this heroic man, John McCain, and that she was going to be able to kind of govern the most powerful country in the world with no experience. And I think there's an awful lot of that kind of romance. And I think there's a paradigm for conservatives there that, you know, that there's a diamond in the rough somewhere out there, that just we need a miracle or we need a strong man like John McCain to see it. Now, you know,
isn't that, though, simply just reinforcing that notion? I mean, if God can pick Joan of Arc or Sarah Palin, or God's surrogate, in this case, John McCain, can pick Sarah Palin, it simply reinforces the notion of the need of a hierarchy.
Absolutely. It's not meant to be a way of supplanting hierarchy. It's just the way that somebody who is a commoner can perhaps imagine or fantasize that they too one day may be part of that splendid hierarchy, that they're not simply beneath it, that they might be themselves one of the elect if a miracle should happen.
And I mean, it's interesting because that theme, I mean, that theme is just huge in, I think, Republican politics, in this notion that, you know, there's an anointing on some level. It certainly has been that case, you know, just if you look at just presidential, Republican presidential politics, you can always predict who's going to be the next nominee based upon they have sort of like come before the court. Mm-hmm. And they've been knighted for the next for the next election. So I'm just curious about this notion of how this sort of same theme regenerates itself over and over again, because we hear in the Republican base this notion of this sort of like anti-establishment, mm-hmm. and this notion of going rogue. is very important, and I'm an outsider. This all plays into that what you mentioned at the beginning, this notion of they keep regenerating it, but they follow the same sort of, paradigm.
Right. I mean, I guess I think about it in sort of these terms, which is when they say things like that, I think that they're thinking is a kind of the opposite of what they're thinking of is a sort of set of liberal institutions. I mean, liberals also believe that people have the capacity for greatness and excellence and extraordinariness. But liberals on the left, I think what we believe is that you need institutions, good public schools, good safety net, good welfare state, healthcare, all of these things you need to have in place so that everybody really has the capacity to express the kind of greatness that they're capable of. Conservatives see that, and all they see is bureaucracy, gray, sort of, you know, Britain in the 1950s, just stifling the kind of miracle that's waiting to happen. And so I think it's more as a kind of polemical argument against the bureaucratization of everyday life or something like that, that they're able to make the case of, you know, we stand for the outsider and all the rest of it. Because in their, you know, and Barack Obama really is the emblem to them of that, you know, went to all the right schools and all the rest of it. And I think that's why, you know, there's really an attraction towards these kind of outsiders. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, they sometimes win. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, was the son of an alcoholic father, poor, you know, didn't go to good schools, was a Hollywood actor, you know, was, I mean, we think of him now, he's remembered as such a statesman, but he was the laughingstock in sort of polite establishment circles throughout the 60s and 70s. Likewise, Richard Nixon, you know. So it's not just symbolism, you know, that there's something to what they're, you know, there's something to it that's more than just, you know, smoke and mirrors.
I want to ask you about this notion of, you mentioned Nixon, and I think it comes across in Nixon as much as anybody else, but it also in terms of Palin and in terms of Reagan and this notion of, I mean, I think you describe it as the politics of loss, and there is this notion in conservatism that they are always victims. Like there is this victimization and this notion. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. There's this notion that the sort of like emancipation of people, either socially or economically, infringes upon them, particularly if you're a white male, because it probably does.
Right.
But
I mean, I think that's the first thing to stress is that the language of victimization on the right is not completely fabricated. When the left is really doing its job with the labor movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, it is taking away power and privilege from people who have quite a bit of power and privilege. And when you take that away, there is a real loss there. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. You don't free the slaves without getting rid of the slaveholder, you know. And that is true. And that's, like I said, that's when the left is doing its job. And so that's part of it. And then the second part of it, which I think is important to remember, is that it goes to the politics of reaction. Conservatives are not just defending a world from the past. They're defending a world that's under threat and under assault from a democratic force. And what they very early understood was that you have to find a new way of defending that world that speaks to the very aspirations of the revolutionary or reformist movement that you're opposing, right? You can't just reiterate the old claims. So one of the things that they found, and this goes back to Edmund Burke, he has a very long discussion in his classic, his sort of masterwork Against the French Revolution, he has this very long discussion of the abduction of Marie Antoinette and the royal family from the Palace of Versailles and the way by a Parisian mob, and that then they're then marched to Paris. And scholars always puzzle why this long, long discussion. And what I think is going on there is that Marie Antoinette really becomes the classic victim. She really is a victim. She's lost everything. She's not a tragic victim like an ancient tragedy where there's nothing you can do about it. She's a modern victim where the whole point is she's lost everything. Let us make her whole. And I think that's the genius of conservatism, is it, 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 it it taps into a very universal language of loss and victimization, and uses it as an argument on behalf of restoration and counter-revolution.
And it's an argument that speaks even to that guy who's making $35,000 a year, and he sees his wife is sort of usurping his power within the household.
Absolutely.
He feels
Absolutely.
That loss. And so, and when you talk about the sort of the radicalism of the conservatives, or that notion that they are constantly trying to overthrow the establishment, it is because the establishment is not doing the a good enough job at essentially halting progress.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing that always strikes me, Barry Goldwater's Consciousness of a Conservative, the very first paragraph, who is the enemy? It's not the welfare state. It's not the Democratic Party. It's not liberals. It's the establishment Republican Party, because they're so apologetic about their defense of capitalism. They don't even really defend capitalism. And so, you know, for every real conservative, your first enemy, your first line of attack is going to be the rest of the ruling class for basically falling down on the job. You need to kind of clear them out and come up with a much, much more forceful, powerful defense. I mean, Ayn Rand hated the business class, or a lot of the business class in America, because she thought they were just so wimpy and apologetic in their defense of capitalism. She wanted a full-throated, you know, hardcore moral defense. And that's what conservatism is always about, is trying to find the kind of, you know, the hard line and the high ground upon which to defend these orders.
And they also are sort of challenged with this notion of keep finding new boogeymen, right? I mean, isn't that sort of like the conservatives' most difficult, I guess, assignment is to find the boogeyman who is taking away this stuff, which is why they have to sort of, you know, 8 years ago it was the gays who were coming
right.
for us, and now. Sadly for them, you know, not enough of the people sort of can of their people can demonize gay people. So now it's on to the Muslims, and now back to the socialists and the commies and the.
Right.
I mean, that's basically their hardest task, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. Sometimes it's actually a very simple task. Like I said, when the left is doing its job, the right has a very simple task of identifying the enemy, because there's a real enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that the gay rights movement was a real enemy to the right, because it is completely about toppling the privileged heterosexual family and heterosexual relationships and heterosexuality. It's saying, you know, you don't have that, you don't occupy that privileged position, you should not occupy it. And that's why I think the battle over gay marriage was for a time so ferocious. And it's what's puzzling to me, I've never been able to figure out, is why it is that the right lost that, or seems to be losing that battle. I mean, there's still a long way to go. So sometimes
I think probably part of the problem is that in fact there is this is one of those cases where there in fact is no price to be paid. I mean, it's very hard. It's one thing to say, okay, I don't have a job because that
right.
woman or that black person has taken my job, but
right.
you can't. I mean, it's a real stretch to say, gosh, the reason why I'm not getting along with my wife is because those gay
right.
guys got married in Massachusetts.
Right, right. I mean, I would say the other thing is that, of course, gays and lesbians are kind of universally distributed across the population. And lo and behold, lots of conservatives, there's gays and lesbians in their families. And that's, you know, the other thing that becomes a little bit trickier. But sometimes they don't have to invent boogeymen. Sometimes, though, and this is where I think you were going, like right now, I think that they do. And it's very interesting watching the rhetoric of the Tea Party of the last year and a half. And I, at the end of the book, and I wrote this, you know, last year when everybody thought the Tea Party was really riding high. Now it doesn't seem to be the case. But I read the Tea Party at the time as a sign of the beginning of the end of the Republican Party, in part because of the shrillness and unreality of the rhetoric, you know, that Obama is a Kenyan socialist Muslim. You know, there's no way, you know, there's no way in hell that Obama is a socialist, or, you know, the other two things as well. But there was, you know, there was a time when McCarthy called the Democrats socialists and communists. There was some truth to what he was saying, because there was a sort of socialist project that lay behind parts of the New Deal. And there was some truth to it. Today there isn't. And what's most interesting to me is somewhere inside of the Republican Party, they know it. And the reason you can know that they know it is that they have not been able to line up behind a frontliner, behind a frontrunner. All this scrambling you've seen for the last 6 months where, you know, it's Michelle Bachmann one day, Rick Perry the other, and so on and so forth, all of it is a symptom of a kind of disarray, which I think is symptomatic of the fact that there is no real left that they can rally against. And because if there were, there would be, you know, the Republicans know how to do discipline very, very well.
Right.
And there's not. And so no matter how many times they'll tell you he's a socialist, if they really believed it, their actions would be otherwise than it is, than they are. And I think it's not until you see a real left, and I don't even mean Occupy Wall Street,
right,
which could be the beginnings, but I mean, you know, a real left that's going to make a real stab for power, not just power in an electoral sense, but really divest these elites of their privileges. Not until you see something like that are you going to see the rebirth of a new conservative movement. And I think that's where we are right now. And that's why all this rhetoric seems so insane, because, you know, in their heart of hearts, they know Obama is, I wouldn't say one of them by any stretch, but he's certainly not the enemy.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the saddest irony, isn't it, is that the failure of the left is ultimately could very well be the destruction that leads to the destruction of the right as we know it at this time.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, that's a perfectly sad moment to end on, but I think you're right. It's I guess this is where the left is playing the ultimate rope-a-dope strategy.
I don't think it's playing any strategy. I mean, it's pretty much making the best probably of a bad circumstance. But, you know, I do think this is why Occupy is a very interesting thing to watch, because my suspicion is that it is the opening shot across the bow, and it's going to take quite a while. But with time, that movement is going to become an extraordinarily formidable movement against the sort of inequality that we've seen in this country. And then you're going to start to see some really profound rethinking on the right, and then some very innovative political organization along the lines of the creation of the Christian right in the first place.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Corey Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And with that, folks, we will go to take a break and come back with Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street, who is down in Washington, D.C. because of your help, covering and participating in the Occupy Congress actions that are taking place as we speak and will be taking place for the rest of the week. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. You folks are so lucky. You're getting an extra 10 minutes free. I'm just too good-hearted to you people. But I wanted you all to hear an update from Jeff Smith, who is live in Washington, D.C., covering, participating in the Occupy Congress actions taking place on today, January 17th, the four-month anniversary of the Occupy movement. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
How you doing, Taylor?
I'm doing great. So where are you?
We are now on the west lawn of the Capitol, right in front of the Capitol steps. And there's about, I'd say, between 2,000 and 3,000 people here. It was raining early, and the crowds are a little slow to get here, but there's still some buses that have just recently arrived from New York and Philly with extra people. So I imagine there'll still be people coming in all the way up until maybe 5 o'clock or so.
So what actions are planned for today? I think I saw a tweet of yours, maybe it was yesterday, saying that some of our actions are going to be somewhat passive. Some of our actions are going to be somewhat more active. What's on the docket for today?
Well, for the afternoon, really, for the morning, we were supposed to have what was supposed to be a cordial meeting with some Congress people. The Capitol building is supposed to be open to the public, certainly the buildings where the congresspersons have their offices, and they have not let us in this morning. They just somehow have been able to keep us from visiting our elected representatives. So this afternoon we're hoping that changes, but that's when I think you're going to see a little bit more aggressive interaction with our elected officials, I would say.
So wait a second. Are you saying congressional offices are not taking any visitors, or are they basically saying you can come in because you're in a suit, but you you look like a ragamuffin, you can't come in?
That's basically what it seems like. I mean, I've seen plenty of people in suits and, you know, what appear to be lobbyists and people that normally go up there being given access, but we had a table that was set up for people to sign up and go to the different buildings where their congresspeople are, and we're being told that they're not letting us in.
Wow. Well, maybe everybody should just hold a sign saying, I'm not with Occupy Wall Street, and see if that helps them get in.
Yeah, so, everyone's here. They've settled us or given us a permit to have this whole West Lawn, but most people wanted to really get up on the steps of Congress and get as close to the buildings as possible, so everyone's pretty much pressed up to one end of the park, or the lawn, and the police have formed a barricade, a human barricade, of cops on motorcycles, and the Capitol Police are standing out there, and it's very reminiscent of what we see in New York a lot. Despite the fact that we were told that the D.C. police have a pretty good relationship with the protesters, it looks like they've decided to give us the New York treatment out here.
Smells like freedom. And so what... this afternoon, things may get a little bit more aggressive. Have there been any arrests so far?
There have been 2 arrests now. I'm not sure exactly why. A situation basically where they told us you need to move off of this space and move back into your designated area, and I guess one person decided to not obey and was dragged out in cuffs, and then another person sort of jumped over the barricades where they are and kind of ran towards the Capitol, and he was tackled and arrested. So, but I think, honestly, we should be able to get into the Capitol, visit the Congress people, and really give them a piece of our mind. I mean, I think the idea of aggressive lobbying is only aggressive because of the message that we're bringing and who we are. Like you said, the occupiers want a piece of our congressman.
And so later this afternoon, there's going to be more attempts to get into the congressional offices. What else can we expect for the rest of the week?
There will be, at some point when we can get enough people here, there will be a march. I think we're being told that we're not going to be able to go to the Supreme Court. They've already barricaded that off from us. But we are planning to go to the mall, and I think there will be people on into the night that perhaps try and set up tents and occupy the mall. So we may see some civil disobedience going on in that respect. And also, I just think that there may be some surprises in store. I met with some direct action people here from D.C., and they're not really telling anyone what they're planning on doing. So I'm going to try and do my best to be in the right place at the right time to catch what's going on.
I understand. Can you cough out the time that it's going to take place? Or maybe this is something that we're going to have to catch up with you either tomorrow or Thursday to find out what happened in retrospect. But I guess people should be following you on Twitter at Don't Be a Putz.
That's correct. And we had a media team meeting last night with people here in D.C. and all the other live tweeters and streamers, et cetera. So hopefully we'll have every building covered where we're potentially going to have stuff going on. And, it's interesting because in a lot of ways, coming here and feeling what the atmosphere is like in D.C., and you think of Occupy Wall Street, the reason why we were in New York is because we felt like the power really was in the money and not so much in the congresspeople. And coming here to D.C., honestly, you get that sense in the same way, that there's almost like a vacuum of power, or the way that the city is able to ignore the occupiers in a way is really disheartening in a sense, when you realize that the congresspeople really just don't care about their constituents, and they've been almost trained to be cynical about populism in any kind of a way, and they really despise us in a way that seems different than in New York. There's also a lot of space here for them to move us to a spot where I think they don't have to walk past us. In Manhattan, you're right on top of everyone, and I think that creates a lot more friction. But I do think that being here and meeting all the people that came from all over the country has been a super experience, and I hope to be able to share more about the different travels and the different people that came over here. I think that's really been an important part of this event.
So there's a little bit of a jaded quality in that city. I can understand it. I mean, I guess it's been 20 years now, but I spent a couple of months there, and I just found the whole place to be just desolate. There is a real sense that the buildings themselves, in some way, even though in New York you get much bigger buildings, but the buildings in D.C. somehow just sort of dwarf everybody. Maybe it's the distance between these things. Well, so, I mean, tell me some of the people that you've come across that have traveled in from across the country. Anybody in particular that stands out?
There are a lot of people have come from the West Coast. I talked to a group that came in from Occupy LA and Santa Cruz, and they rode the train for 80 hours to get out here. And they're planning on, I mean, they brought all their camping gear. And the one thing about D.C. that's really, I think, still special is the fact that they still have a camp. There's a couple of camps, really, but the one at McPherson Square, there's definitely, you get that nostalgia of people living together and the sort of creativity that comes from that kind of, you know, common shared space. And so I think that is definitely still special and alive here in D.C. and makes me hope that, you know, we start to see those similar sort of encampments pop up again around the country when it gets warmer.
I noticed today there was a couple of stories, Washington, the Wall Street Journal, I think it was the Post, that Occupy Wall Street has frozen spending on new projects. Donations are off. What can you tell me about that?
That's true. Really, I don't think it was anything more than a response to some of the problems we've had allocating the money and the sort of fighting that's come with having that big bank account. So I don't think that it really spells doom for the movement in any kind of a way. We still have $100,000 that's specifically set aside for bail, which is probably the most important allocation of funds. And I think that for certain direct actions and things like that, we'll be able to raise funds moving forward. But, I mean, the entire system of Occupy Wall Street was never really set up to be an NGO in a traditional sense or to allocate huge amounts of money. And I think what you saw is a group that sort of come to an agreement amongst itself that maybe this shouldn't be the kind of thing that we should be doing. We sort of saw money corrupt in the same way as we're protesting against in our government. And so I think it was sort of heartening to see a group actually discuss the issues, fiscal issues, in a real way and come to kind of a grown-up decision on, you know, what's important to spend money on and what we should stop. And you compare that to our actual Congress that talks about fiscal discipline but has never actually enacted it in any way. And we actually have a surplus. We're not operating at a deficit, and we're already thinking about, you know, long-term budgeting goals and things like that. So I think it was a very interesting process, and again, points to the fact that Occupy Wall Street is much more than just marches and a group of people, you know, playing hacky sack in a park. It very much is a sort of political body, and when people become a part of it, I think they learn a lot of things about their own government from the experience.
Well, just one heads up. It seems that John Huntsman's dad has got one less expense now. So I'm just saying, he's pretty wealthy. And now with the Huntsman running out, stepping out of the race, he may be looking to get into politics in some other fashion. So I don't know. It's just a suggestion.
You're suggesting John Huntsman might become an occupier, or what?
I'm saying maybe his dad is. Now that John's not running, maybe he's got some extra change around that he thought he was going to have to spend. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
All right. Just keep your eyes on that. We will we'll be in touch. I'll shoot you an email. We'll either hook up tomorrow or Thursday. Thank you for the work you're doing, and keep us updated. Direct actions to be taking place this week, folks. But loose lips sink ships, as it were. Jeff Smith, thanks so much. Don't be a putz on Twitter.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, now we will head to the better half of the program, wherein I will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. I will take your IMs at Majority FM. I will be discussing just a really heartwarming story of corporate malfeasance by Pacific Gas and Electric Company. An update on SOPA and PIPA. The side that we're rooting for, the side that says keep an open and free internet, has won at least a, maybe not just temporary, but a significant victory. Of course, it's simply a war between really wealthy interests and other really wealthy interests. But fortunately, in this fight, the regular folk have some aristocracy on their side. Just to maintain the Corey Robin frame. Also coming up, a hilarious story about Arizona. I mean, just a hilarious story. You know, they sold their capital. Apparently, they found out that's not such a great idea. They literally sold their capital. See you in the better half of the program. Again, if you can become a member, I don't want to beg you, but I'll beg you. If you can become a member, become a member. It's the right thing to do. Everybody's doing it. Well, not everybody. You can also support this show by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. If you're going to buy crap through Amazon, you might as well do it through our link. We get a kickback. You can also buy Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. It's delicious. It's a great company. 10% coupon code. Use the coupon MAJORITY. You get 10% off. You can't have a better deal. We have merchandise you can buy. People are loving the mugs and the shirts, the member shirts. And also, give us a review on recommendation on iTunes. Do it. Citizen Radio has like twice as many as ours. All right, see you in the better half.